Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hey, Holly.
Hey, Dave.
How are you today on the What Difference Does It Make podcast?
It is definitely a great day on the What Difference Does It Make podcast. We're discussing how much we like talking to Hollywood types.
You shouldn't do quotes. He is a Hollywood type. He made a movie. We love movies. I love movies probably more than you. You don't go to the movies too much, but I'm kidding.
I'm going to have to argue with you there. I do love going to movies. I just don't do it as much. I love movies.
Okay.
Just, you know, with so much good TV content, it's hard to pull myself away.
All right. Well, we love movies, and this is a man named Thomas Robsom, and he has directed Aha! The Movie, and Holly and I both got an advanced screening of it and loved it. When we first saw that this is a documentary about Aha, we were like, I don't know. We didn't have an Aha moment until we saw it. And then like, oh, Aha, I get it. It's kind of interesting, especially a band that a lot of people, myself included, think of them as a one-hit wonder. But, you know, what happens to a band after that? You know, just because they're not huge in the United States, there's a whole other world going on where they're still playing music.
We were surprised to learn how successful they are in the almost entire rest of the world. So it was really great to see all the personalities, seeing the behind the scenes with the band.
We love movies. We love social media. Where can they find the What Difference Does It Make podcast on social media and learn more about the movies that Thomas Robsom has made?
So on social media, you can find us at WDDIM Podcast and on YouTube at What Difference Does It Make Podcast. You'll find clips from this interview with Thomas Robsom and many others.
Fun fact, he also is a producer for one of my favorite films that was nominated for an Academy Award, Worst Person in the World. He is the producer. It's a beautiful film, and I loved it a lot. So we're talking two films in this podcast today. So why don't we just get right into it? This is Thomas Robsom on the What Difference Does It Make podcast.
Hello.
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 Where in the world are you right now?
I'm between Oslo and a small city called Hamar, where I live, which is 1.5 hour outside of Oslo.
We are an 80s music podcast, and even though, you know, like you've got your, this Academy Award nominated movie, Worst Person in the World, is a pretty big deal. Let's talk Aha first and work our way to probably the headliner, I guess, would be a way to look at it.
Well, for us, Aha would be the headliner. For the rest of the world, it might be Worst Person in the World. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Can you explain Aha to me? I mean, we know Aha as a band that had a number one hit, Smash, all over the world, so big that the James Bond people noticed it. They had a top 20 hit in the United States, and then they kind of fell off. But they keep going on. They continued, and why don't you kind of give like a brief rundown of what is Aha?
And the extent of their success in the rest of the world.
Yeah, well, you know, Aha were three very ambitious young men who decided to go to London to break through and to be pop stars. You know, they decided that when they were very young, and they were totally convinced that they would succeed, and nobody else was convinced. So even I, who knew some people that went to London when they were there, they met them and they even heard their music and thought they were terrible. And when they showed up on television in Norway for the first time, everybody thought it was kind of, you know, it wasn't very convincing. But at the same time, we really hoped for it because Norway had nothing culturally. You know, we had no films that anybody knew. We had no football players that anybody knew, no music, nothing. So we hoped that they would succeed, but we didn't think they would. But then they did. And it's really strange that they lost the US so quickly. I guess they had this idea that they could have a hit and then do whatever they wanted, just like the Beatles had done. Mm. But the problem was that the Beatles spent four or five 6 years being a pop band, and then they started doing the other thing. But a-ha started immediately after the hit. And so the second album was not what people probably expected after Take On Me. So America was lost. But in the rest of the world, in UK and South America, all over the world, they continued being a big, big band. And even after breaking up, after five albums or having a pause, they came back and it turned out they were still really big. And for the last 20 years, they've toured a lot, released new records, and still have really big audiences. I mean, bigger than many other bands that you might think are bigger. I mean, they are probably one of the biggest bands from the 80s, if you look at it from, you know, how many people go and see their shows. I think for sure U2 are bigger, and The Cure, and certainly some American bands I don't even remember now, but they are bigger than many bands that are more famous.
I guess it sounds like just tenacity on their part, just to the fact that they thought they could make it in London. There, you know, both of us watched the documentary, which we love, but there wasn't a lot of video footage of them performing in London. Was there a reason that, because it was so bad, that it's like, you know what, we don't need to show this?
No, well, you know, they are on Top of the Pops, and the first time they were on Norwegian television is in the film, and also the terrible first music video. So I think you see some of, you know, that things didn't turn out exactly like they wanted in the beginning. But then when they start touring, of course, they also did London. Many of the years they spent in London was, of course, you know, trying, and then finally succeeding, strangely enough, with the American Warner Brothers, not with the British. So it was also luck, you know. They were really, really lucky, because the music video was, of course, extremely important for the breakthrough. I don't think the music video is so important these days, because the song does great also without it. But for the breakthrough, the video was really important.
Did you have a connection to them? I mean, you're Norwegian, they're Norwegian. Did you know of them as they were up and coming in Norway, for however much time they spent trying to make it there?
I didn't know them personally, but we had heard about these guys that had gone to London. Also, Paul and Magne had the band Bridges before a-ha, and they released an album that I had noticed that it had been released. For me, as a punk, it was a little bit too hippie-ish, so I didn't buy it. But I noticed that they also released it by themselves on their own label, which was very inspired by the punk movement. Because in 1980, everybody started in Norway to release their own records. And I know that that was something that inspired them. And also, I think they felt that there was no good music in Norway through the 70s. And the only time they felt that something interesting was happening was when punk and post-punk bands started coming up in Norway in the early 80s. And also, when they went to England, they felt that, you know, there is some competition. There are some great bands there. But they also were clearly inspired by you know, bands like Soft Cell, Depeche Mode, and Echo and the Bunnymen, and all of those also came from punk. They were punks starting to make more interesting music. You know, that was how I knew them, that I knew that they had gone to try this out, and that they had returned a couple of times without succeeding. And finally they made it. And for me personally, when I heard their second single, The Sun Always Shines on TV, that's when I felt that, oh my God, these guys really have something special. We've never heard anything like this in Norway.
Crazy.
that was inspiring for everyone in Norway, and it opened up doors. Even today, you know, we see Norwegian bands and artists that clearly have got the self-confidence from what a-ha achieved.
You mentioned that there was a couple tries, unsuccessful tries. They described their initial take on Take On Me as the Juicy Fruit song. Did they recognize immediately that they had some? I mean, it's really fascinating because they recognized that there was something in this song, but they couldn't quite put it together. And they had a couple runs at it until they got it right.
Yeah, it was even more than a couple because, you know, they had the song in Bridges in the previous band, and then it was a rock song. And then when they brought it on to a-ha, they tried it with different titles and different versions, also as an a-ha song, and then going more in a synth pop direction. And Morten insisted on that song, while Paul was not so convinced, especially since he didn't like the chorus, so he changed that after a while. I think there's like 5 versions of that song.
So they've had a long career, and yeah, especially for guys that don't, they there's, now, I don't want to call it contentiousness within the band, but didn't always appear to get along with each other or to even like each other that much.
Yeah, you know, bands don't get started because 4 guys or girls know each other for 10 years and then they start a band. Most bands start because, you know, out of 30 people, there's one playing guitar. And if you're lucky, you have a friend that plays another instrument, and then you start searching for other ones. Do you know a drummer? Yeah, I've heard about this drummer. She lives over there. And then suddenly you have a band, and most of those bands just, you know, finish after a while. But if that band becomes world famous and get hits, then you are stuck with those people for the rest of your life. So that's the problem with so many bands, you know, that suddenly you have to deal with these people that you would maybe never see again, you know, if the band was not successful. So I guess that's the story of a-ha and the story of many bands. But their stubbornness and their personalities is also the reason why they had success, I think, you know, that they really believed in things that everybody thought was a joke. And they just insisted, and they felt that we have music that is good enough. And we have this singer, and he has a great voice, and we write great music, and it is at top international level. If we get some help, we're going to make it. And you need, you know, to say that to yourself and to others in the late 70s and early 80s in Norway was insane, but totally insane. Now you can say it, and nobody will, and people say, yeah, maybe you're right. And most people just laughed at them, but they still continued. So for a while, they were very together, you know, and it was those three against the world. But after they had the breakthrough, what happens is, you know, Morten gets all the attention and everybody thinks he looks great and sings great, and Paul gets recognition for being a fantastic songwriter, and people kind of don't notice that Magne has been a really important part of the songwriting too. He wrote the riff on Take On Me. It's paying all their bills today. And so all three kind of don't feel appreciated in their own band by the other two. It's a big problem with this band, you know. They don't appreciate each other's talents enough to really make the band as good as it could have been, because they could have been even bigger.
And ego too. You know, some bands are willing to share everything completely, songwriting credits, everything equally.
Yeah, well, you know, I can kind of understand all three in some crazy way, because I can also understand that Paul, you know, if you write 90% of a song and you have a very clear idea of how you want the song, and then somebody helps you with a small part, and then they are suddenly, you know, 50-50 in a way, mm-hmm. you know, as a credit. I can understand that can feel strange also. Yeah. I think in a band you have to divide everything, because it's not just the songwriting that is important yeah. in a band, it's everything. So when bands, you know, you get one member of a band being like 10 times richer than the other guys, you know, then you start getting problems. And songwriting is how you make money mostly. Yeah. So I think that if the manager had come in and said, okay, I'm going to sign you, but only if we divide everything between the three, because, you know, I'm signing all of three of you, and I think this band is going to be successful only if you three are the ones from now and forever. And then that could have sold a lot, because at that stage, I think everybody would have said, okay, that's fine.
So Morton was the one who got most of the attention in public, because in the film, it didn't look like they were so resentful of that.
I think they thought it was okay on one hand, but on the other hand, Paul and Max, they argue a lot about songwriting and those things. But Mort and the other two have very different tastes in music and very different views on life. Morton is a Christian. The other two are more like socialists or social democrats, typically Norwegian. I think they view the world quite differently. mm-hmm. When Morton kind of fronted the band and sometimes maybe said things that the others didn't agree with, and also he was the new one in the band. It's kind of like, why does this new guy in the band get all the attention? We built this up for years mm-hmm. before he came in. So I think maybe they thought it was a little bit more difficult than they admitted in the film.
Well, let's talk about the film, this documentary. How did you approach these guys? What was it, your idea first? Like, okay, or what was it that drove you to like, I've got to get this done. This is something I need to do.
It started when I was 10 years old.
Okay.
8 years before AHA even started.
Wow. That's quite a story.
Yeah. And kind of like almost 50 years before the film was even done. It started when I saw Let It Be, the film about the Beatles. I was a big Beatles fan as a child. And when I saw that film, I was shocked because they argued, but I was also very impressed by, you know, being there while they made the Beatles music. I mean, that film stuck with me for so many years. And for a long time, it was also unavailable. So I didn't see it again until quite recently. And then, of course, Get Back was the ultimate version of that material. But it was funny to see it again, because it turned out they only argued for like 90 seconds or something. Most of it. So, I mean, I don't see why the Beatles were so dissatisfied with that film. But I know now when you see Get Back and you see how much material they had. But anyway, so when I started making films myself, to make a film about a band making a record has always been something I wanted to do. So that was something I tried to do in the late 80s, early 90s, and it always stopped because I didn't find the financing. Because in documentary, it's always tough to get financing for music documentaries, or at least it used to be, because there are so many, you know, more important topics. You know, social topics, or, you know, war all over the world, and all kinds of topics that are kind of more important when you ask for that kind of money, like we do in Norway, where we need, you know, public funding. And also the TV channels don't have money to finance, and they don't think music is kind of important enough to finance it. So it didn't happen with different Norwegian bands I tried in the 80s and 90s. But I didn't try AHA because I was sure that they were too big at that point, you know. And in the 90s they also had a big break where they didn't play mm-hmm. together for 6 years, and then I was, you know, busy with other things for many years. But then in 2009 Mags showed up at the premiere of a film I produced, and where I also made the film music, the score, because we ran out of money, so I had to make the music myself. And he actually congratulated me on the music and thought that the film music I made for the film was great. So he sent me an email, which I kind of have now put in a frame, a gold frame. But that was an occasion for me. Then I remember that when I read that email, and when I thought about it the day after, I thought, shit, this is my occasion now. In 2009, they had made their ninth album. It was very successful. They had new hits in the UK. And they actually were planning to try to get into the States again. They had a new manager. Everything was looking good for the band. So I wrote an email to Mags and said, wouldn't it be a great idea if I made a film about your 10th album, the kind of anniversary album, and the album where you make a big new impact, because everything is kind of going in the right direction now. And so Magne answered, it's a great idea, but there's just one problem. We're not going to make a new album because we're going to split up. So in 2010, they split. And I, of course, said to him that, okay, but call me when you get back together.
This is a Beatles situation. Yeah.
And he said, it's never going to happen. And then, of course, they did get back together in 2015, suddenly with a new album. And so I wrote him, hey, you forgot to call me. And he said, well, but this album was made like all our recent albums. We're not actually together. Everything is made separately. Morten makes songs in Stockholm. Paul makes songs in New York. I make my songs in Oslo. And then we just put them together and argue about which songs should be in the album and not. And it's the usual thing. But then I said, okay, but can we start filming? Maybe you're going to make another album. I hope you're not splitting up again. And he said, yeah, well, talk to the manager. I'm positive, but talk to the manager. And the manager first said, well, since Magne says so, I can send an email to the other two. But when I send emails to the band, I get an answer every 100 emails. Mm. So I wouldn't have my hopes too high. I don't think they're going to want this to happen. And then he called me back 10 minutes later and said, I don't know who you are. I have to Google you, because they all said yes in 10 minutes. And that never happens. And it was lucky that Paul was awake over in LA. But yeah, so they are positive. So then I said, okay, so can we have a meeting? Because I would like to meet everybody and talk about the film and tell you what I want to do and, you know, see what you want me to do and whatever. And the manager said, we don't do meetings. So we never meet. So you just have to show up at the tour, and I can't promise you anything. They've said yes, so let's see what happens. And that's basically what happened for the next 4 or 5 years, that I showed up and tried to get as much material as I could. And separately, they are available. I can text them and meet them and do interviews or film things. But the hard thing is to get them together. So no, as you saw in the film, you know, no new album while I was making the film. So I didn't actually make the film I dreamt of. But still, I hope I made a film that made more people listen to A-ha, because that was my main ambition.
All right. We are talking A-ha on the What Difference Does It Make podcast. But our A-ha moment is we need to somehow get this podcast some cash. So we're going to take a break and we'll be right back.
We're back on the What Difference Does It Make podcast with Thomas Robson. Obviously, we're fans of 80s music and we're fans of music in general, but the footage that you included in the film, I think, would draw a lot of people in to see them live. Seeing the footage, really, it drew me in.
Definitely. When they had the number one hit in the US, they had never played live together. They had played a few shows with Bridges and a few shows with Morten's band, but I don't think it was more than like 10 shows each or something. So then they had to rehearse a lot and get some backing musicians. And in the beginning of their first tour, I don't think it was the best live band in the world. But then I think maybe the best live version of A-ha was in the early 90s when they played in South America and everything was live. You know, it was really a live feeling. And after they came back together again from 2000 and on, it's still great, but it's not as loose as it was in the early 90s. And Morten is more, you know, always with the listening issues and everything, which kind of, you know, he really enjoyed it in the early 90s, actually. You know, if you see the footage from South America, he's... Yeah. Yeah. Runs around and is really having a good time.
Can you tell me about this Rock and Rio show? I mean, how did this come about? This is a whole other part of the world. And this was
the biggest show? How many people? And what do you know about Rock and Rio with a-ha?
The thing is that somebody told them, you know, that you might sell less records than you used to here in Europe, but you are big, big, big in South America. And in those days, you didn't, you know, a lot of sales were, you know, under the radar. You didn't get the sales report, kind of, we have sold 100,000 in Brazil, that's great. No, it's actually 1 million, but 900,000 of those copies are bootleg copies of the album, or they don't report every sale. So they had a much bigger audience in South America than they realized, because based on the official sales, it didn't seem so big. So when they actually went down there and played, you know, it was a festival, but it was one show for each night. So you have Prince playing one night, filling it up quite good with like 60, 70,000 people. And then you have Guns N' Roses also filling it up quite good with 60, 70,000. And then you have a-ha, and they sell every possible ticket. You know, the official number was 180,000 people in that stadium. I mean, it must have looked quite empty those other two nights. But they, of course, thought that was great, but they were really sorry about the fact that MTV, that had been, you know, MTV was where they broke through, and they won all the MTV Music Awards and everything. And then not even 10 years later, they play Rock in Rio, and they are the only band that's not mentioned when they have a special from Rock in Rio. They don't even mention that the A-ha play there, and they have twice the audience or more than the other bands. It was in the Guinness Book of Records for years.
Crazy. Okay, so you touched on MTV, and you also, you know, like these pencil sketches, you put that into the film, like these, you know, little snippets of flashbacks and things, which I thought was really creative. Did you do the, I mean, you have this talent, it seems like, or how does this pencil sketch animation work? I still don't understand it to this day.
It's the big secret.
It's much easier these days, because when they made the music video, they had to actually paint every single frame or draw every single frame. So there were thousands of drawings to make that. You shoot a person, like when Morten sings and works around the different rooms, they just record that as a normal music video, and then they paint over it. But they had to make every single drawing by hand. But nowadays, this is done with some help from computers. So it's much easier, or we would have no chance to afford it.
Yeah.
But the idea actually came because I was thinking, okay, in the first years when they are children and when they are young and when they have their first bands, and even the early days of a-ha, there won't be much material. So I will have to use the same still photography like 10 times. And I don't want that. So I need something. I need to shoot something. And then I just thought, I actually thought it was maybe an idea that was a bit too obvious. So I was a little bit concerned that it wouldn't work out as good and that people would just think, he took that idea. But it was nice. They did a great job in Germany doing the animation. And I shot and edited all the scenes with live action. And I just told them where I wanted the animation, you know, to go from live action to animation and back again. And also I had this idea that in the end of the film, they become the animated guys again, because that's their fate. Yeah. You know, they have to go up on stage and do Take on Me, you know, that's what they have to do for the rest of their lives. And that's also very telling of being in a band. You know, if you get a hit, you will always have to play it. And even though they didn't want to be a cartoon band after a while, you know, you can't escape the success you have. You have to, you know, Stones have to play Satisfaction and so on. Mm-hmm. Most bands have to play the big hit. Yeah, so it was an idea that came really early.
Sometimes the best ideas are right in front of you. So.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. You have to trust those ideas and not be so afraid that some people might not like them. Yeah.
No one's going to turn off the film if they don't like it, but I think it would really, it serves to draw people in, even though you want them to get the band currently, you know, the whole, arc of the band, the emotion of it, you know, the memories of it draws them in, I would think.
And they are plugging in, they have a new album coming out. This is what they're going to be plugging.
As soon as I stopped filming, they made a new album.
Bastards.
Yeah, I guess they were tired of having me around for 5 years.
So one film that you are, I think, kind of interested in is this film, The Worst Person in the World. How did you get attached to this? I mean, you're the producer on this film. And did the script fall in your hands and like, this could be something good?
No, I've worked with the director for many years.
Okay.
So this was the third film we did together, or in a way the fourth film, because I was executive producer on the first one. And then we did three films in a row now that I produced. So yeah, we did Louder Than Bombs in the US. We were in New York for half a year to do that with Gabriel Byrne and Jesse Eisenberg and Isabelle Huppert. That was that came out in 2015. And then we did a film called Thelma in 2017. But this time everything fell into place. This time, you know, everything just clicked. We were in Cannes in the main competition already with Louder Than Bombs. And the previous film, Oslo 31st of August, was also in Cannes, but in a side program. But we came back this time back to Cannes in the main competition. But when the actress won the award for best actress, that's when everything kind of changed. And the film almost traveled on its own out in the world. And we have now more than 1 million admissions worldwide, which is crazy for a film like this. It places it as one of the most seen Norwegian films ever. And, you know, it's not a commercial film. You know, from the starting point, it was just another arthouse film, a little more light than his previous films, but still an arthouse film. So it's just an adventure. You know, I was convinced that it would do better than his previous films, I mean commercially, but I didn't see it coming in this way.
And who's the actress who plays Julie?
She's called Renate Reinsve, and this is her first big role. She has done some television and some other films, but this is her first as the main actress.
Just a knockout. Amazing. Quite a film.
I didn't only watch Let It Be when I was 10 years old. I also watched the Oscar shows. And when I started, you know, and I come from a film family. And of course, you know, you kind of feel that, you know, you should at one point be there, you know, to feel that you have done what you could in the business. And so being the first in the family, a big film family where everybody, both on my father's side and on my mother's side, are either directors, actors, producers, or whatever. So that's great. On behalf of the whole family, I'm going there.
Oh, congratulations.
Let's say you're at the governor's party, and who are you going to make a beeline for? Like, I have to say hello to this person for my parents, for my whole family. Who do I need to talk to just to say I love you so much?
I've met this 50... super famous people in my life, including Morten Harket. So I'm not going to stand there, you know, looking at people, you know, if they come to me, we can talk.
Well, you know, everyone has their, like Dave has his Bruce Springsteen, you know, he may not approach Clint Eastwood, but you would definitely approach Bruce Springsteen.
If you saw Spielberg, would you go up to him and say, you know, hello, I've admired your work.
I admire your work.
You do good stuff.
The thing is, It's really strange because you kind of don't want to do that because you think that they get that all day long, every day, so you don't do it. But when people come up to me, you know, and say, I really love your Aha film, I think it's nice. But it would have been Paul Thomas Anderson.
Oh, is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Valley
and
Boy.
He loves the film. You know, we are not sure which appreciation we prefer the most, if it's Barack Obama having it as one of his favorite films or Paul Thomas Anderson. You know, it's really tight between the two.
You can say both. You don't have to rank them.
Yeah, both of those were like great moments for us, of course, that they love the film.
Well, if you when you come to Los Angeles and if you need a tour of the San Fernando Valley, Holly and I can both do that. This is where we grew up. So it's
I've been to Los Angeles just once, and I always thought because I didn't have a reason to go. I've actually been the Norwegian candidate for the Oscar. You know, they choose one candidate from each country, and then you have to fight to get on the shortlist and then to be nominated. And I've been Norwegian candidate with films four times, but the first time we were chosen, I couldn't go because my daughter. Small at the time, or quite small. She was actually in the film, but still somebody had to stay at home. So the director, who was my previous partner, went over with the actress, and I stayed at home. And the second time I was a candidate was with Thelma. So then we went over, and that was my first time in L.A. And I was sure I was going to hate L.A. I was totally convinced because I'm a New York kind of guy. Yeah. Where I've been lots of times. But I loved LA much more than I expected. I loved the climate. I loved going around in the studios. And I felt kind of like, this is where I should be. The thing is that when I went to Los Angeles, I loved it much more than I expected. And I really loved to be down on Venice. So I booked a hotel in Venice. And that's also where Paul from AHA lives. Oh. He lives on Venice. But he's on tour. So I'm going to meet his son, which I've gotten to know well, and his wife, Lauren. Who and they love the film, which Paul doesn't. But
is that right? Yes. Is that
Paul feels that it's too much conflict, and he feels that the other two get to say, just tell their story. I try to get all of them to tell their story, and they will never agree on the story of AHA anyway. And most people, or all people that see the film, kind of like all three and understand all three. And that was my ambition. But Paul feels that the other two get too much, to tell their part of it. And also, he doesn't dislike the film, I think, as a whole. But he just feels that kind of maybe too much on the conflict. And I'm a little bit sad about it because Paul was the one I connected the most with during the shoot. But I just had to be very honest about what I found when I made the film. I went in there and this is what I found. And he was the first one to talk about the conflicts. And so I had to follow up with the other two. And it would be strange to make a film about AHA without mentioning the conflicts. And also, I don't think it would be a film that would get such great reactions as because if it becomes only kind of a fan film, even though I am a fan, but if it becomes just about, the surface, then, all the great music films have conflicts in them, and all the great bands have conflicts. That's a quote from Paul. So, if you are a great band, we should also focus on the conflicts. In 10 years' time, he's going to love it.
I think that's a badge of honor, actually. If all three have something that they don't agree, they don't think it's great, then I think you made it perfect. If everyone's up, if there was just one person, like if Morton was happy with it and the other two were upset, then it wouldn't have worked. You made everyone like, well, you could have done this better. Yeah. So as long as everyone's a little disgruntled, I think you did a good job with it.
Thank you.
That's AHA right there.
Yeah.
We wanted to see the conflict. I feel fulfilled.
Yeah. No, honestly, yes. As growing up in the 80s, we didn't know much about AHA, but it's kind of cool. I often wonder about these bands that, were huge and then they seemingly disappear, but, they don't disappear. They're still musicians. They still want to play. And that's what that's their passion. So you were able to continue that story. And so, a United States audience can kind of fall in love with this band again. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, I hope so. And I'm actually surprised about how many interviews people want from the States. I mean, it's actually more than any other country. And in Germany and UK, they are still huge. But in the US, I'm doing more interviews for US than in Norway and UK and Germany. And that surprises me. But I think the thing that might work in the States even more than in Norway is exactly the fact that the band has been hidden for so many years. That happened with a Danish band that were huge in the 70s, and then they disappeared. And when they made a documentary about them, like I think it was 15 years ago in Denmark, that was an enormous success in cinemas in Denmark, because everybody was wondering what happened with that band.
Yeah.
Why did they break up? They were so successful. Why did they break up?
Which
what
band?
Happened with the other men? It was a band called Gasoline.
Gasoline.
And they were produced by the same producer as Queen, but they didn't make it outside of... Actually, they spent most of the money they earned in Denmark, they spent on trying to make it in the U.S. and failed.
Yeah.
So when the band broke up, they were all broke, even though they were so enormously successful.
Yeah.
So that documentary is great. It's one of my favorites. The guitar player had to go on welfare a couple of weeks after the band broke up. And so the person at the office, you know, asking, why do you need, you know, money from us? You know, you were in Gasoline, yeah. You know? And his answer is, it's up and down in showbiz.
Would you believe us if we told you this is the second conversation this week we're having about Gasoline?
The band?
Yeah.
Are you kidding?
We interviewed it. We had a Danish guest on the show this week.
Oh, that's fantastic. But you haven't heard the music.
No, we have not.
No, but we're going to now.
Yeah, now I have to dig up this documentary.
Yeah,
you should. It's really great. It's one of my favorites, actually.
Amazing.
I'm doubly inspired now.
Right. So congratulations on Worst Person in the World and Aha, the movie. We had a great time watching it, and it was really wonderful. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, and congratulations.
Yes. Take care.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay. Wonderful chat with Thomas Robsom. I thoroughly enjoyed it. He was in his car when he was talking to us, so it still worked out perfectly fine. It was great to learn a little bit about the band Aha. And a little bit about Worst Person in the World, and a lot about Thomas Robsom.
And we only learned at the end that he had his daughter in the car with him, so she sacrificed a whole hour of car time with her dad for this, so thank you to her.
Thank you to Jolynn Matsumura for setting this up with us. It was a true treat to talk with Thomas, and we've got new episodes every Friday, don't we?
New episodes every Friday, and also a thank you to Pantheon Podcasts, our great big podcast family.
Also subscribe, and if you love what you heard, of course, reviews and stars and green clovers and whatever else, blue diamonds, I don't know, whatever you do.
You sound like you're talking about Lucky Charms.
I am. Well, it is the day after St. Patrick's Day, so it's on my mind. All right, so let's just wrap this up. Thank you again to Holly, as always. It was wonderful chatting with you, seeing you from a virtual distance.
And you as well. Thank you, Dave.
Well, thanks. Okay, so until next time, this is Dave.
This is Holly.
Check you later.
Over and out.